I've been thinking a lot about mosquitoes lately. Partly because of all the headlines about the Zika virus, but also because there's a new proposal out there that some pretty eminent scientists are taking very seriously. A proposal to wipe mosquitoes off the face of the earth. To just kill them. All. For good. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, and we're talking about a bioengineered mass mosquitocide. And not just because of Zika, but because of malaria, dengue, yellow fever. I mean, every year, hundreds of thousands of people die from mosquito-borne diseases. When you add it up, more people have died from mosquitoes than from war. But still, deliberately kill off a species? Charles Monroe Kane called writer Dan Engber to check it out.
So first thing, okay, let's assume, just for sake of argument, that we're going to do this, that we're going to destroy all mosquitoes in the world. Mm-hmm. How many lives do you guess that would save in a year?
So, you know, malaria kills, I checked the WHO stats, and they say 600,000 people a year, mostly children. The other mosquito-borne illnesses are less deadly but significant. So, I mean, I think we can say reasonably at least 6 million, maybe 8 million per decade.
Let's also talk financially here for a second, though. We spend a lot of money dealing with mosquitoes in this world, with diseases and with sprays and insecticides and larvicides. Do you have any idea of how much money we would save if we killed all the mosquitoes?
Yeah. You know, there was a study done of the financial impact of dengue fever in Brazil. So we're just talking about one disease here. We're not even talking about malaria. We're just talking about one country, although it is a country that has major problems with mosquito-borne diseases. And the researchers found that it was more than $1 billion per year in terms of the costs of just dealing with dengue fever. That doesn't include all of the money that Brazil spends on controlling mosquitoes, which is another $1 billion a year. So, I mean, the amount of money that goes into caring for people with these diseases, spending money on mosquito control, and then loss of economic growth. I mean, it's staggering. There's another estimate that I saw that looked at countries in sub-Saharan Africa and made the assertion that the disease impact of malaria slows economic growth by some just huge amount. I think it amounts to, the cost amounts to 1.3% of GDP. I mean, it is staggering how much money this costs and how much misery it causes in terms of death, but also, you know, morbidity, just people who are getting sick but not dying. And then, of course, we're not even talking about all of the hassle that mosquitoes cause to everyone else, just inconvenient and annoying.
Let's move this argument forward. Let's do the fun part, okay? Let's kill them. Okay. Let's kill them, man. How would one destroy all the mosquitoes in the world?
There has been in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, a lot of progress towards using genetic modification to come up with ways to control and possibly eliminate mosquitoes. The simplest method, which relates back to something that's been used in the U.S. at least for insect control for maybe 60 years, I think, 70 years, is to release sterile insects into the population. Now, you can sterilize them with X-rays or ultraviolet light, or in the case of mosquitoes, you can genetically engineer male mosquitoes to be sterile. You release them into the wild, and they mate with females, and they just sort of, I guess, waste the female's time so you're not getting as many baby mosquitoes. So that's one approach. That's not going to eliminate all mosquitoes, but it is a way, using genetically modified mosquitoes, to really control the populations without spraying poison everywhere. It may end up being very cost-effective and safe for the environment, although, you know, there are a lot of people who are a little freaked out by the idea of using these kind of, you know, Frankenflies to do your work for you.
You know, every time, I'm just thinking about splitting the atom, for example, and a lot of other things we've done in science. We don't have a very good track record when humans mess with nature. What do you think? I mean, you're afraid of some, like, mutant mosquitoes taking over New York kind of thing? I mean, why not, right?
Yeah, I mean, what I just described, that's the soft approach. That's the one that's being field tested already in Brazil and other places. That one, I'm not worried about at all, but there's a much more...
Oh, I knew you were going to say that. Okay, where's the risky ones going on?
There's a more powerful and potentially frightening approach, which uses something called gene driver technology. And with this form of genetically modified mosquito, you can release, you know, some set number of them into a wild population, and that gene spreads. Basically, it preferentially spreads itself, and through a few generations, this can completely replace a local population. And so this is called population replacement instead of population control. And that's where you get into this issue of, you know, you are now just taking out this wild population and replacing it entirely, 100%, with a lab-created and lab-grown species. And then, of course, if you wanted to, you could engineer into those lab-grown mosquitoes some kind of ticking time bomb. You could put in a vulnerability. You could make it so that as soon as the seasons change, all these mosquitoes are going to die through some temperature signal, or you could just make them all vulnerable to a particular, you know, otherwise harmless chemical. So you can really pretty easily, and I use that in a qualified way because these technologies are not fully ready to go, but this is something that will work in principle. This could easily destroy a local population. Then you get into those questions, well, what if some of those mosquitoes that you've released into this local population start spreading around the world? What if this gene driver technology, you know, runs amok? And now you're taking out mosquitoes not just in this Zika-ridden corner of Brazil, but all throughout South America, all throughout North America, and now all around the world.
What if they did destroy all the mosquitoes? What if that happened and it went around and all 3,500 species die and there were no more mosquitoes? Like, what would happen if there were no more mosquitoes?
I mean, that's an empirical question. It's not one we can have the answer to without doing something potentially dangerous. The answer is people don't exactly know, of course. We've never done it before. But what we do know, based on what we know, it doesn't seem that likely to cause major ecological problems. So you can say, all right, well, it's not going to be good for the mosquito fish, which is adapted to eating mosquitoes if mosquitoes go away. But if you look just, you know, more broadly, there aren't a lot of species that rely so intensely on mosquitoes. They don't seem to serve that vital a role in any ecosystem that we know of. They're pretty numerous in the Arctic tundra, for example, but it's not clear if even birds that nest in the Arctic tundra are likely to suffer all that much if the mosquitoes went away. Again, this is not an exact science. I'm just saying, based on the research that's been done on which species eat mosquitoes and whether those species could, of birds, let's say, or bats or whatever, could find something else to eat, there just is not any really, that I've found, any really compelling studies showing that there would be a huge problem if the mosquitoes went away.
You know, it's funny. I was talking to my friends about this who had some pretty strong reactions. There's another person I talked to about this. It's my daughter, and she's 8. And I told her, say, what do you think about this? You know what she said? She goes, well, Daddy, aren't they part of the food chain?
Well, yeah.
I get your argument, but there's a logic that she's giving that says there's a logic in nature. Maybe we're just going against nature, and that just seems like a mistake in general.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a religious or spiritual argument. So this idea of the food chain, I think, is very related to the idea of the great chain of being. And it's this idea that God, or if we don't believe in God, nature has created this beautiful tapestry, and every thread is vital to keeping the whole thing together. That just doesn't seem to be true. It can't be true. If it were true, when passenger pigeons went away, it would have set off a chain reaction that would have destroyed all life on Earth. I mean, humans, we go around driving species extinct all the time. Natural disasters drive species extinct. Species go extinct. There is a huge problem with a loss of biodiversity overall. But I don't believe that this idea that all God's critters are keystone species, and everything we know, let me put it this way, everything we know leads us to believe that life on Earth is resilient and robust, and yet I feel like there is kind of this quasi-religious sentiment that, you know, everything is so fragile, and if we just do the tiniest thing wrong, we're going to tip things out of balance and it'll all fall apart. It's just, it's totally out of step with what we've actually done and observed in the world.
Daniel Engwer is a columnist for Slate. Charles Monroe Kane talked with him. I don't know, maybe I'm being soft-hearted, but it still seems kind of extreme, not to mention risky, to bioengineer a mass mosquito die-off. So Steve Paulson tracked down the world's greatest living entomologist for his take. E.O. Wilson. He's sometimes called the Ant Man. That's the insect he studied most. But he's best known as an evolutionary biologist and a champion of biodiversity. He's 86 years old now, and he's just finished what is probably his last book. It's called Half Earth, a proposal to save humanity by dedicating half the planet to nature. So I would have assumed that Wilson would be happy to let mosquitoes live in their half, but that's not what he told Steve.
Given your reputation as such a prominent advocate for biodiversity, there was one chapter in your book that I found absolutely fascinating where you say there are a few species you would not mind seeing going extinct. For instance, the African guinea worm and several species of mosquitoes. Can you explain your thinking?
Yeah, there might be even a longer list when we get down to it. There are species in the world which are specialized on and have been in many cases for tens of thousands or longer, specialized on humans. They can only live on humans. And of course, there have been lots of macroorganisms, pathogens that are specialized to live with them and use them to feed on humans. Malaria, various forms of bacteria, viruses. And these include a group of mosquitoes called the Anopheles gambiae mosquito. The genus Anopheles, incidentally, has come into prominence recently through Anopheles aegypti, which is the Zika carrier,
right,
the virus carrier. Never mind, we don't want to wipe out Anopheles because that's a vital link in the food chains of a lot of the world. But Anopheles gambiae, that group of species in Africa, co-evolved with people over thousands of years and is, you know, specialized to live in human settlements and to get human blood. That's how it lives. And as a result, it spreads malaria. It's a principal conveyor of malaria. That's one I wouldn't mind seeing going. What I would do would be make a good sample and get them into liquid nitrogen. We haven't gotten rid of every genome of the smallpox virus, and I think we could do the same,
yeah,
but we need to get them off the face of the earth for our own minimal welfare.
If just these mosquito species that carry these human diseases, if they were targeted and wiped out, that would be okay. I mean, environmentally, the impact wouldn't be severe?
You have to find out which species are carrying which pathogens, and then you can go after them, sure. It's highly unlikely that you could eliminate them entirely. But there will be regions where the pathogens also occur, and that's where you want to take the mosquitoes out. We want to take Anopheles aegypti out, and if we can, in the Zika areas and also in the malaria areas, and also yellow fever, which is persisting. Wherever those occur, I'm all in favor of reducing Anopheles aegypti. I would not want to see the species wiped out entirely, though, until we could make much more cautious estimates of how that would affect all the rest of life.
No, I'm curious, is there any precedent for this kind of thinking? I mean, to intentionally try to eradicate an entire animal species?
Sure. You mean deliberately in
yes.
order to eradicate it?
Right.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure,
obviously we've unintentionally wiped out a bunch, but deliberately.
Yes. One case was the flesh fly, which is a dreadful fly that lays its eggs on just scratches and wounds of animals, and the larvae hatching burrow into the living flesh of the animals. It was causing a lot of problems with livestock of various kinds, but including cattle. It's a ghastly kind of an animal, and just for economic reasons, it made sense to take it out over the main area where it was causing considerable damage to animals, to the economy. And the method invented to take it out was to breed in the laboratory vast numbers of males and then sterilize them and then release them over the areas where the mating was taking place. And the lady flesh flies didn't know the difference. And this actually succeeded to eliminate the flesh fly over a lot of critical areas.
And that's exactly what people are talking about with these mosquito species as well.
It is. I'm just saying that aside from Anopheles gambiae, the malaria carrier that's adapted to human beings, in particular in Africa, and a dreadful agent of malaria carrying, which I would gladly throw the switch and be the executor myself. What we need to do in dealing with these creatures around the world that for one reason or other are causing different degrees of harm to human beings, and I cannot emphasize enough, this is a minute fraction of the millions of species of insects and other small creatures of this kind. Of them, we should make removal of populations, maybe occasionally even entire species, highly informed and surgical, not with mass destruction of whole populations, because we don't know what damage we're doing to everything else when we attempt something like that.
Doesn't this raise the specter of humans playing God? I mean, even if we acknowledge that certain kinds of mosquitoes cause all kinds of harm to humans, is it justified morally for us to intentionally try to engineer the extinction of another species?
In extreme cases like the one we're describing, yes.
Now, I have talked with some other scientists and some science journalists who frankly were startled to hear that you, E.O. Wilson, the most famous entomologist in the world, have said that it would be okay to eradicate certain mosquito species. It felt like a kind of turning point in a way about how we talk about this idea. And I guess I'm wondering, you know, given your standing in the scientific world, whether you feel some personal responsibility for taking a position like this.
Well, of course. I always thought we should get rid of Anopheles gambiae. We know enough about those species, and we know the damage that they're doing. To reemphasize one more time, we believe that there are as many as 2 million or more species of insects alone. A large percentage of those are flies, and including mosquitoes. Species, that many, 2 million. I'm talking about a very small number of species because they have co-evolved with us. And the preying on humans would certainly be acceptable to remove them. It's just, I believe, common sense and its morality needs to be considered, that has a strong scientific basis.
That's E.O. Wilson. He's one of the world's greatest living biologists. He's 86 years old, and his latest book, just out, is called Half Earth. Steve Paulson talked with him. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. We've been talking about bioengineering mosquitoes off the face of the planet, deliberately making at least some types of them extinct. And I listen to this and I think, where's the grief, the sense of regret? Isn't there anything about mosquitoes we'd miss? This is David Rothenberg playing music with insects. He's recorded songs with a lot of them, with crickets and cicadas, and yes, even mosquitoes. Producer Craig Ely sat down with David Rothenberg to talk bug music.
They've been there as humanity evolved. Millions of years before us, millions of years before birds and whales and anything else. The insects were here first, and we kind of intuitively know that there's something to respect there about these ancient creatures. We like buzzy, rattly, kind of scratchy sounds. We have percussion instruments that make them. You know, the mbira in Africa, the thumb piano, you have to stick little pieces of metal on the end to make it buzz and make it more noisy, to make it more liked. You know, you plug a guitar and get some feedback and fuzz. We like that kind of thing, and maybe it comes back from our whole species evolving in the midst of exciting, rhythmic, overlapping insect sounds. This is the earliest music that's around. As humanity started to decide what sounds we should make. We heard all these sounds around. You know, insects make polyrhythms. You know, they're making overlapping sounds that really fit together into complex, organized, but wild and loose patterns. Just like what we try and do in music, we want to be rhythmic and exact, but not too exact. We have to have this irregularity.
So speaking of tiny, tiny vibrational movements, there's this one scientist, or it's a group of scientists that you talk about, who can actually listen inside a mosquito's brain. Is that right?
That's right. Igor Sokolov. I think he did this work at Clarkson University. And this, of course, I heard on a radio story first. And there you had that, you know, he offered up the sounds inside a mosquito's brain. And these are not like what we hear when a mosquito is buzzing in our ear. It's how the molecules are moving against each other, recorded in a microscopic way. And he wanted to demonstrate that the sound of the living molecules in the brain is different than a dead one, you know, where they're also moving around. You could hear the sound of life at its most minute. Even bee sounds or wasp sounds are more fun. Something about the mosquito sound is something you imagine is going to keep you up all night buzzing and whining around in your ear. You don't want to wear headphones and listen to this.
Yeah, I mean, why do you think that is? Is it just that element of danger?
I think it's annoyance. You know, I don't think at that moment people are thinking about the terrible diseases you can get from mosquitoes, because although many of us, if you travel in these places, you know mosquitoes are dangerous, I think more significantly to most of us, they are annoying. And if you spend time in places where there's so many mosquitoes that to be annoyed by them is a ridiculous luxury, like go to the Arctic, go to Alaska, or go to Lapland, and there's just mosquitoes everywhere. People living there, they just accept it. You just get into it after a while. They're not so dangerous in these places as much as annoying and bothersome, and there they are. You get used to it, which is an interesting fact of insect sound. Do people then love the sound in some way? I imagine there are some yoiks, kind of Sami, Lap, Arctic, Finnish, Swedish music, where people sing the sound of an animal. And mm-hmm. I bet you could find a mosquito yoik, because the sound is so cool. And the one piece on my record, Inside the Mosquito's Brain, it's all made out of artificial sounds that are like what the mosquito is doing. Spend time listening to these things, you start to hear different things as being musical. Mm-hmm. You know, you're just like any music. You know, you listen to Indian music for the first time, it all sounds the same. And then if you learn more about it, there's so many subtleties and differences. You listen to electronic dance music, it's all the same beat, the same stuff. Until you learn more about it, you realize that, boy, within this sameness that seems the same from the outside, inside is a huge amount of variation and specific differences that you have to take time to figure out.
You know, David, we've talked to some people over the course of this show who are, you know, really seriously entertaining the idea that the mosquito should be eradicated. But, you know, you are actually someone who's played music with them. You're an artist who's kind of engaged with the mosquito. How does that make you feel?
Of course, it would be a deep tragedy to lose the whine. You know, the incessant whine, the annoying sound of the mosquito. If this sound was no longer heard, we would have lost something important to humanity and human evolution. And people would spend a lot of time trying to recreate that sound and keep it going, just like the people who long for the sounds of millions of passenger pigeons flying overhead. No one can believe there were ever that many pigeons. And what was the sound like? We don't know. So if the mosquito is eradicated, then we better practice how to retain and engage with and remember its sound, as annoying as it might be, that there is something valuable in that as well. You can't get rid of everything you don't like. You have to put up with it. And you have to celebrate, you know, a sound that's so powerful. Celebrate the whine, that really could bother you, but celebrate the fact that sound can have such power.
David Rothenberg. His latest CD and the book about his collaborations with insects is called Bug Music. Craig Ely talked with him. And if you want to hear more Bug Music, Craig put all the tracks from the book on our website at ttbook.org. So there's a serious proposal on the table this hour. Should we genetically engineer the extinction of disease-carrying species of mosquitoes? The technology seems to exist, and some pretty prominent scientists think that we should. Well, let's check in with Sonia Shah. She's a science journalist who writes about pandemics and pathogens and the social history of disease. She wrote one of the best histories of malaria. It's a book called The Fever. And she has a pretty different perspective on the whole kill or be killed debate. One of the reasons that we haven't gotten rid of malaria or of the mosquitoes that cause it has to do not just with science, but with politics and economics. Can you sort of explain a bit more?
So people who are poor are more likely to get malaria, and that's because they live in ways that exposes them to mosquitoes. They live in rudimentary housing without screens on their windows or without screens on their doors. This allows mosquitoes to come in. They're less likely to have electricity, which means they are outdoors more and they're not indoors at night, potentially being exposed to mosquitoes. And then they live on, you know, kind of marginal lands with poorly drained roads around them, and these capture standing water where mosquitoes can breed. So just by virtue of, you know, living in poverty, you're much more likely to get bitten by mosquitoes.
Hmm. And then there's a culture as well, right? I mean, for instance, your family is from India and you grew up spending summers there. But I've heard you say that when you told them that you were going to be writing a book about malaria, they all thought you were crazy.
Yeah, they thought I must have been desperate for book ideas or something, because to them, writing a book about malaria is like writing a book about warts or like the common cold, or, you know, just something so ordinary that why would it be interesting? Why would you ever write about that? That gets to the heart of sort of the cultural problem of mosquito-borne diseases like malaria, which is that the people who have the most malaria tend to kind of care about it the least. It becomes kind of a normal problem of life. And this is something medical anthropologists have found again and again. Like, you and I might think of malaria as a killer disease that you would do anything to avoid. But people who live with a lot of malaria, they don't think of it that way.
Hmm. And that makes it harder to fight. Why? Because people are less likely to, I don't know, sleep under their bed nets or get to the doctor the first time they have an infection?
Yeah, all of those things. You know, I mean, most of these interventions that we've come up with for controlling malaria rely upon people at risk of malaria taking actions. You know, they either have to go to the doctor as soon as they get sick to get diagnosed and to get their prescriptions, and then they have to fill the prescriptions, and they have to keep taking the drugs. They have to sleep under the net every night. They have to put on the repellents. These are all things that require them to feel like this is important and this is worth doing. But, you know, think about what you or I, or those of us who live in temperate parts of the world, think about the precautions we take to protect ourselves, say, against flu or colds. I mean, we barely wash our hands enough, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, say you had like a bunch of experts from Africa come over to the United States and say, you know, you people are losing $40 billion a year on cold and flu, and all these people are dying every year. You know, all you have to do is wear a mask over your face for, you know, 6 weeks of flu season when you go to school or work.
And it would be easy for you to say.
Well, exactly. We would say, why bother? We'll just get a cold.
Let's talk a little bit about the history of our war on mosquitoes, because And even just as I say that, I'm thinking how interesting it is that we use the language and the logic of conquest to talk about dealing with mosquitoes. You know, it's always a war. We're always trying to come up with the next weapon to use against them. Maybe that's just inevitable, or is there actually a problem embedded in that?
If you look in the long view, we've spent a lot of time and money trying to control mosquitoes, but we've also let a lot of things slide. I mean, ever since we've come up with powerful insecticides, you know, probably since the 1940s with the development of DDT, we've done a lot less with sort of managing the environment or looking really deeply into mosquito biology and mosquito ecology to see how we could tinker with it so that we could actually live with mosquitoes and without the diseases they carry. You know, we've kind of taken this all-out slaughter approach because we've developed enough powerful insecticides that can do that. So we're not really doing enough in terms of kind of a specialized attack on the exact kind of mosquitoes and the exact kind of mosquito bait behaviors that we're trying to control.
But I really like your point that that in some ways what we're doing is trying to just wipe out, you know, an entire population. And that's one model, but that a different model, which suggested, well, let's see how we can live with these things, you know, or maybe only kill a few of them, that might actually open up the door to different paradigms for thinking about how to get rid of them.
I mean, in the end, what we have to rupture and reduce is mosquito biting of people. You know, and we've seen in other parts of the world that sometimes, and this is not all species of mosquitoes, some are very, very focused on biting humans and only humans. But there's other species of mosquitoes that are more flexible. In England, in southern England, they used to have a lot of malaria there. And this was back when they didn't have a big livestock herds because they didn't have, you know, good enough agriculture to keep their livestock herds alive during the winter and things like that. So when they introduced four-crop rotation into England, this allowed for larger harvests and more fodder crops, and they could keep their livestock alive for longer. So they had bigger and bigger herds of cow and sheep. And this ended up reducing malaria to such an extent that it eventually vanished because the malaria mosquitoes, it turns out, they didn't have any choice before that. But once there's all these sheep and cow and pig around, they preferred to bite them.
So we just offer them an alternative prey.
Yeah, I mean, there was actually Rockefeller Foundation scientists who said at the time, the cure for malaria might be just a pig under every bed.
That might be a lot cheaper than what we're doing now.
Yeah, a little messy, but yeah, cheaper.
Well, that makes me think, you know, malaria used to be a big problem in the United States. I mean, you're living near Baltimore in a place that was formerly ravaged by yellow fever and malaria. But we don't have much malaria in the U.S. today. So how did we stop it?
Well, there's a number of things we did, and we did most of them without thinking about malaria. We just did them for other reasons. We got rid of about half of our wetlands. You know, and that was just the urban expansion and the expansion of our farms and things. So that destroyed a lot of mosquito habitat. And then we had malaria kind of hanging on, particularly in the South, particularly among sharecroppers, because these are people who were, you know, living on marginal lands. They were living in shacks. They didn't have electricity. So in all these ways, they had what I would call a malarious way of life. And we kind of ended that by social policy. We started the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which mechanized farms, Tennessee Valley Authority, which brought electricity to rural areas. And all of that really ended that malarious way of life. And as we ended that malarious way of life, malaria vanished too.
Are you suggesting that instead of focusing so much on combating malaria in other parts of the world, it might be better to focus on combating poverty?
I think so, and I think there's another reason why that would make more sense, which is that people actually want help with that. You know, people in malarious countries and malarious societies don't necessarily feel that malaria is their top problem in life. They feel like their top problem in life is better job, better harvests, more financial security, a future for their children, education, things like that. So really, we're talking about just basic development, basic economic prosperity. And there are malaria scientists who say that what we need to do to end malaria is basically have, you know, centers of economic development where people can become a little bit more prosperous. And if they become a little bit more prosperous, they'll get more electricity and they'll have better homes and they'll start grading the streets so there's not as much standing water. And you kind of build that out in sort of concentric circles until you have a cycle of more wealth, more health, more wealth, more health.
Do you think there's something patronizing about our current efforts to combat malaria? Because most are led by Western scientists or Western philanthropists like Bill and Melinda Gates, for instance. And it sounds like you're suggesting, well, we're combating what we think is a problem, but it may not be the same problem that people in the countries with malaria think they have.
Yeah, I think there is a definite sort of cultural collision, some cognitive dissonance in the way people who have malaria experience the disease and the way the people who have the wherewithal to fight malaria experience the disease. And that has led to, you know, certain problems where we decided here in the West, Western scientists decided that, well, why don't we treat all these bed nets with insecticide, and that'll last for 5 to 7 years. It's really cheap, it's really easy, and we can distribute this by the hundreds of millions across malarious Africa. But in fact, what was happening is they were distributing the nets, but people weren't actually using them.
Why not?
Well, there's a number of problems. Well, you know, sometimes it was a square net and they live in a round hut, or this net was the nicest thing that they had. You know, these are really poor people living in remote areas. And this was the nicest thing that they had, this, like, you know, very well-made synthetic material with a fine mesh. So they used it for other things that they valued more, like fishing nets or curtains or even wedding veils. Some people would just store them and only bring them out when, you know, honored guests came to kind of show them that they had this thing. So it just didn't fit into people's lives the way that we might have imagined it did.
So what should we be doing? I mean, if you could be, I don't know, world mosquito czar, what would you do?
I don't think I want that job. I think malaria really is 1,000 different diseases. It's different everywhere it occurs. So it's almost like a local issue, you know, and we can empower local communities to come up with local solutions. And sometimes those actually can be fairly simple. And there's some really great examples of that. And for example, in Dar es Salaam, where, you know, local research revealed that the malaria mosquitoes were breeding in the drainage ditches that were blocked by garbage. And so the malaria intervention became, let's hire some kids to clear this garbage out, you know, and this allowed the water to run through. And that actually worked to bring malaria down, too. That's not going to work everywhere. You know, that'll work in that one place. In parts of China, they found that malaria mosquitoes were breeding in the irrigation canals in rice farms. And so the malaria intervention became, well, let's raise the level of the water in these irrigation canals, and that washed the mosquito eggs away. Or they would lower it, and that would leave the mosquito eggs kind of high and dry, and they would desiccate. And that worked to bring malaria down. But it's not going to work everywhere.
Sonia Shah is a science writer and author of The Fever, How Malaria Has Ruled Humankind for 500,000 Years. She's also just come out with a new book called The Pandemic. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Listen to that. Just listen to it. It's got to be one of the most annoying sounds on earth. The way it just kind of burrows into your brain is enough to make mosquito side start to seem pretty attractive. We hate mosquitoes. But why? I mean, yes, West Nile, dengue, malaria, Zika, not to mention ruined picnics, sleepless nights, and bites that you scratch until they bleed. These are all logical reasons to dislike mosquitoes. But admit it, they also just creep you out. Jeffrey Lockwood gets at this psychology in his book, The Infested Mind. He's an entomologist who once had a truly horrific encounter with a swarm of grasshoppers. He was traumatized, but he also started thinking about why we fear and loathe insects quite so much. He told Raymond Tungekar the answer lies deep, deep in our psyches.
Fear and disgust basically protect us from things in the world. Fear, for the most part, protects us from immediate danger. Disgust, on the other hand, tends to protect us from bodily invasion, contamination, and infection. And so, you know, we're not afraid of a pool of vomit, and we're not disgusted by standing at the edge of the Grand Canyon. But both of these, that is, falling great distances and becoming infected, are real dangers in our evolutionary history. And so we've developed very different sorts of approaches to them. In some ways, they're similar in that, you know, we feel that we need to get away, or at least we need to get the thing away from us. But they come apart in these important ways because the kind of danger that they represent is not the same. But that's not to say that some people actually can feel both fear and disgust, particularly in the presence of some insects, which is pretty interesting.
Okay, well, let's unpack this. Let's take fear first. How have, you know, psychologists throughout time tried to explain a fear of insects?
Right. A good argument would be that it is evolutionarily rooted, which isn't to say that we're evolutionarily necessarily primed to fear insects in particular. Rather, I think the way to understand our fear of insects is to understand that what we've inherited is a propensity. Some people say prepared learning. In other words, we're prepared to learn about these tiny skittering creatures. In a way, it's a bit like language, right? We're not born speaking Chinese. We're not born speaking Japanese or Russian or English. But we are born prepared to learn. So when the environment gives us an opportunity, we're ready. And to a very important extent, the same might be said of insects. And for, say, early people, that response was very nuanced, right? So, you know, as a kid, your parents would indicate which ones were good snacks and which ones were capable of inflicting pain. And that was passed on generation to generation culturally. Now today, with, you know, the development of a highly urbanized society, what culture has layered on this attentiveness is almost always a negative sort of judgment. You know, very few people living in a city have good reason to have a positive affect or a positive response to an insect, right? They're, you know, if they're bed bugs, if they're cockroaches, or you're out running and you're surrounded by a swarm of mosquitoes, none of those are good news for you. You know, you might find butterflies kind of attractive in the park, but really most of your experiences with insects in the city are pretty negative. And so we've come up with this sort of general cultural, you know, rule, right, or heuristic, and that is things with six legs are bad news, either squash them or run away from them. And so that's sort of how we respond in terms of a fearful response to insects. Again, culture layering on to this evolutionarily prepared learning.
Well, what I never understood, or what I find kind of interesting, is that there's no logic to it, right? I mean, for instance, like compare mosquitoes and spiders. I think more people are afraid of spiders than they are mosquitoes, when mosquitoes probably pose a greater danger.
Oh, my goodness, yes. As a matter of fact, mosquitoes might be arguably the most dangerous animals on Earth. I think that you'd be hard-pressed to make an argument that they aren't the most dangerous animals on Earth.
And yet we kind of regard them as a nuisance. They're not like, you know, flying weapons of disaster.
No, we see them as more pesky than anything else. Although, just to digress momentarily, the U.S. Entomological Warfare Division did develop mosquitoes as a biological or an entomological weapon during the Cold War.
Wait, really?
They had the capacity to mass produce the yellow fever mosquito and even had done target analysis on enemy targets, particularly communist nations. They had devices, whole bombshells, and they'd even done test releases of uninfected yellow fever mosquitoes on unsuspecting populations in the United States to see how effective they would spread and bite.
Wait, so the U.S. government released mosquitoes, uninfected mosquitoes, within the U.S.?
Yes.
That's incredible. Huh.
Yeah. Right. So there's a dark chapter of mosquito biology and a reason that we might want to fear our government almost as much as we should fear mosquitoes, perhaps. You know, the reality, I suppose, is that we are only recently in human history, and basically in the last century, have we become aware of the imminent danger that mosquitoes mean. I mean, until you figure out that mosquitoes are spreading disease, they are just a pesky sort of thing. The name malaria refers to bad air, right? And so we associated swampy habitats with these fevers. What we were missing was the link to the mosquitoes. The thought was that it was the bad air that was causing these miasmas or fevers, when in fact it was the mosquitoes. And that connection is made, you know, about 100 years ago. And so we've got several hundred thousand years of evolutionary experience with the immediate pain inflicted by a spider, but we've only got a century of knowledge about the dangers of a mosquito. I mean, you know, if you think about phobias, so people have phobias of, you know, they might have an entomophobia, they might be afraid of spiders, but they ought to be more afraid of mosquitoes. And for most people, at least in, say, North America, what they really ought to have is a phobia of guns. But we don't. We don't see much in the way of, I'm not sure what the scientific term for gun phobia is, but we don't actually fear, at least we don't fear in a pathological sense, those things that are, in fact, in recent human history, most dangerous to us. And I think that's because we're playing with the deck of cards that were dealt to us, you know, 200,000 years ago. And it takes a while to change that sort of underlying infrastructure of the human psyche. So there may come a time when mosquitoes and guns are feared more than spiders and cockroaches, but I don't think it's going to happen soon.
Do you see signs, though, that we're kind of reaching some kind of turning point in that, though? I mean, you have established scientists and government agencies actually talking about wiping out entire species of mosquito.
Yes, absolutely. And that is a... that is a level of fear that seems, you know, maybe in a sense phobic in terms of the way in which we understand a phobia, or psychologists define a phobia as a persistent, excessive, and unreasonable fear. The desire to wipe out an entire species might qualify as a persistent, excessive, and unreasonable fear.
Is there any historical precedent for this? I mean, have any other similar insect species in the past been villainized quite to this extent?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, it's interesting because we, you know, if you look back in sort of the last 50 years or so, we sort of let down our guard and figured out that we were, you know, sort of immune somehow from insect invasions. And then we end up with Lyme disease and West Nile virus. Response to West Nile virus was strong, but not quite as, I don't think it was anywhere near as dramatic as it is to the Zika virus and mosquitoes. You know, the closest thing that I think I might point to is our response to bed bugs. The explosion of interest and the phenomenal social psychological response to bed bugs. And I don't want to compare bed bugs to mosquitoes carrying a Zika virus, because bed bugs don't transmit any pathogen at all, mm-hmm. right? And so they really are sort of pure annoyance. The response to those creatures and the psychological response and the stories of people burning their furniture and going to these extraordinary lengths to try to rid themselves of bed bugs and the social stigma associated with them, you know, was utterly disproportionate to, you know, to sort of the objective medical risk. But they were pushing our buttons. They're crawling into our bed at night and feeding on our blood and disappearing. I mean, they're basically little insect vampires. They even tap into that whole mythology. And to a certain extent, I think mosquitoes do that as well. They feed in ways that are very, very sneaky. They're taking our blood. You know, they tap into this whole notion of the vampire as well, of something that's difficult to kill, that always returns, that can't quite be defeated by technology, and that invades our home and our bodies in this very intimate and frightening way.
You know, I also wonder if, I mean, one of the reasons it's so unnerving is that, I mean, in an era in which we have the power to bioengineer an entire species out of existence, it's really humbling to know that a lowly mosquito could have such power over us. It's kind of insane and humbling in a way.
No, I was talking to a potential graduate student the other day who was applying to our program in ecology, and I was talking about entomology and saying that, you know, one of the wonderful things about being an entomologist is this sort of humility that comes with it when you really understand, you know, what's running the world, and you begin to understand how tenuous our sense of technological control is and how limited our knowledge is. I mean, that's the worry with this notion of bioengineering a species out of existence. I mean, the two great worries are, in one sense, what role might this species be playing in the environment, especially a widely distributed species, playing in terms of the transmission of pathogens to or other organisms that are important to environmental processes? What other roles might this thing be playing in terms of nutrient cycling and whatnot? So what we know is that it does one thing, right? And we know that it transmits this virus to us. All the other things, all the other ecological functions that this species might be playing are, for the most part, poorly known or completely unknown. So that's the one worry. And of course, on the other side is the worry of the slippery slope. If we were to do this, how do we know what the next target is? Is it cockroaches? Should it be rats? How about pigeons? Is it okay to wipe out bed bugs? They're annoying and they don't seem to play much role at all in ecological processes. And so once we begin down this path, how do we know which organisms warrant extinction? Where do we stop?
Jeffrey Lockwood is an entomologist. His latest book is called The Infested Mind: Why Humans Fear, Loathe, and Love Insects. Raymond Tungekar talked with him. Hey, thanks for listening today. I hope you enjoyed it and maybe heard something worth sharing. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Charles Monroe Kane produced this hour. He had help from Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Doug Gordon. Our theme music comes from Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Those annoying mosquito sounds we tortured you with come from Free Sound. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. We'll be back next week.
PRI, Public Radio International.